Reverend John Edgerton is lead pastor at First United Church of Oak Park near Chicago. This year, during the pre-Easter season of Lent, which calls Christians to reflection and contemplation, the socially conscious welcoming congregation undertook a fast from whiteness, an idea that requires both nuance and thoughtfulness to understand. But that didn't stop the rabid right-wing outrage machine from bringing the fires of heck to bear on the faith community, both because it's a storytelling in its own right and a frightening example of how far off the rails the right-wing religious freedom industry has gone. I am grateful to be joined right now by Reverend Edgerton. John, you've been through a whole lot. Thank you for finding time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you for the invitation, Welton, and good to be here with you.
A fast from whiteness. Now, I can see how those words, those three words, could be a trigger for the screaming heads who don't look beyond, well, the first three words. What, in fact, is the premise and the promise of the fast?
To me, this begins from an understanding of what the Christian practice of fasting is all about. And you don't fast from things that are ugly. You don't fast from things that are despicable. You fast from things that do tug at your heart, that do take up space in your heart and in your life. And fasting from those things is done for a season in order to open up space in your life, open up space in your heart and in your spirit for the divine to enter. And so for us, this fast from whiteness looked like removing things like Bach or Mozart or Messiaen or those kinds of wonderful contributions to sacred music that I do love and that have shaped me. And by clearing out that space in our communal worship life, we created space for new voices like Stephen Cuthbert Molefe from South Africa and a host of other voices that have made amazing contributions to sacred music for us. And so this has really been a fast in that spiritual sense.
Well, what do you see as the valuable goals behind launching such an initiative?
This is a time in our nation, like other seasons as well, when we must reckon with the history of race and racism in this country. And it is incumbent upon the faith community to take up the work of anti-racism now, to find ways to extricate white-centeredness, the assumption that whiteness is the norm. The church, if we are to be faithful to Jesus Christ, who was a dark-skinned man from a poor part of town, if we are to be faithful to Jesus as we meet him in the Gospels, then we must find ways to move beyond white-centeredness in our faith. And this is work that can only be done by predominantly white churches, because our voices will always have a hearing, will always have a place in the public square. For predominantly white congregations like ours to take up this work is crucial and life-giving work for our nation today.
So what kind of activities or actions did you encourage congregants to take as a part of this effort?
Well, I'm very glad you asked that. I think that in the national conversation around this, this has focused entirely on our musical choices. But for your listeners who are familiar with church, This was a whole church-wide program built around this theme, and it actually began with our Sunday school. That's how all of this began, was our partnering with a local congregation, St. Christopher's Episcopal Church, which had created a Montessori-style Sunday school program, begun as started by a woman named Jan Enriquez, that's called Tell Me the Truth About Racism. And in an age-appropriate way and in a spiritual way, we taught about the history of this country, the painful history of how this country has treated people of color, Native people, Indigenous people. And we hold up the truth that God has made all people beloved. And we hold that up against what we call the lie, which is that some people are better than others. And that lie is at the core of so much misery. From there, we decided this 6-week long program fit nicely with the 6 weeks of Lent. And so why not build our entire worship life around this same theme, around anti-racism work? And so we did this in our music. We did this in our liturgy. We did this with the bulletin cover art, highlighting the photography of James C. Lewis, who has made an unbelievable series called Icons of the Bible, 163 photographic portraits of figures from the faith and figures from the Bible, with models for these photographs being entirely people of color. It is a gorgeous and stunning contribution to sacred art. In addition to our musical programs, we were inviting people to take up the reality, the reparative work of pushing against the racist way that copyright law has worked in this country. Mm-hmm. I think that in deciding that we were going to use a great deal of music that was part of the African American spirituals tradition, for example, we knew that those works are predominantly in the public domain. And they are in the public domain because of systemic racist history of how the copyright laws have worked. And so although when we sing songs by Ruth Duck or Marty Haugen, we will pay royalties through CCLI licenses, for example. If we were to take up in earnest singing far more songs from the spiritual tradition, we would be contributing to the lack of fair compensation for artists of color who have made these contributions. And so what we did was we decided that we would follow a practice begun by First United Parish of Brookline in Massachusetts of paying royalties in the form of taking up money that we pay to a local nonprofit that is on the south side of Chicago that does work with young people of color. And so this is our way of trying to do some reparative work in a way that is appropriate for church. And so this was about so much more than the selection of hymns for our congregation, and it was so rich and rewarding as a spiritual journey. One thing that is always important to me as a pastor is to explain the practices of the church as if those who are hearing them for the first time.
Yeah.
For some people, that is literally true. Yeah. As fewer and fewer people grow up in church, people come later in life for many reasons and may never have practiced a Lenten fast before.
Yeah.
And for others, it is simply important to explain it as if for fresh ears so that they might experience it anew as well. And so we began with simple teaching of the traditions of the church, explaining what a fast is all about, explaining why we fast, trying to extricate it as much as possible from feelings of shame, but rather about opening up space inside the spirit so that the time of Lent could be could be one of depth of spiritual journey. So that was really how we began, just by teaching on a basic level what Lent
is all about. Well, it's a great way to begin. How big is your congregation, and did pretty much everybody take part?
So our membership is 650 people or so. Mm-hmm. And for us, as many other churches, Lent is one of our most well-attended seasons mm-hmm. of the year. Mm-hmm. Advent is a high season for attendance, and Lent too is a high season for attendance. And so we experienced in this period of time an unusually high level of participation, even by the standards of Lent. We had many more times than we normally would have. We had greater attendance in our in-person services. We had greater attendance in our online option as well, since that we are, like many faith communities, having a hybrid service, some in-person, some online. Mm-hmm. And so the engagement was really very strong, and people were just loving the programming that we were doing.
That's great. Please talk about the what kind of backlash came, because we know there was an incredible backlash that came from the right-wing echo chamber. Talk about that.
This came as a real surprise to us. I am a person, I've been pastoring for about 12 years, and I've always had church programming and sermon series and that kind of thing. And never has the programming of my church sparked even local news coverage, much less national and international news coverage. So this was a surprise. We awoke on a Tuesday, the Tuesday before Palm Sunday, and we found that this had been covered on Charlie Kirk's radio show for Turning Point USA. That story quickly was picked up, and within a day, it had become national and even international news, with the core of what was being reported always being the text written by the Turning Point USA author. Mm-hmm. And we started receiving an enormous number of messages across all platforms. Our phones were ringing off the hook. We were receiving 5 voicemails per minute, at one point. We were receiving, over the course of 2 days, we received well over 1,000 messages of voicemails, emails, messages on Facebook. And I won't even begin to estimate the social media comments that, initially it was a flurry of negative comments. By the following week, however, we were receiving a large number of messages of support as well. Mm. So it's been quite a journey.
How did you feel about receiving all of these things that were negative?
Well, we really received 3 different kinds of negative messages. One was thoughtful, scripturally based criticism from other Christians taking issue with what we had done. The second was comments which were composed entirely of the basest vulgarity. And both of those are fine, although I much prefer the former to the latter. Both of those are fine. The third kind of communication that we got were threats. And those were made mostly against me personally, but also against a specific threat against our Palm Sunday service, mm-hmm. where an individual said that they were going to, after indicating in colorful language that they were not pleased with what we had done, saying that he was going to bring a bunch of people with him and come to our service on Palm Sunday and, quote, we should have a real good time together. And again, given the context of the rest of his message, it was clear that he was not going to bring us a large cake. So this was making threats against people because you do not like the way that they practice their religion. Yeah. That is a crime. And we reported those things to law enforcement. We worked with local and federal law enforcement to investigate those things. And it is un-American to threaten people because of the way that they practice their faith.
You've spoken eloquently about this experience being an attack on religious freedom.
Well, freedom of speech is certainly a centrally important part of our Constitution, and in this very same amendment is guaranteed the right of the free exercise of religion. Yeah. And that is, that also involves being free from harassment and threats. That's a civil right. Those in the, as our civil rights are protected, they are protected not only from government overreach, but certain civil rights are protected also from our fellow Americans seeking to infringe upon those for other Americans. And so this is a question for me about the civil rights of our congregation to freely practice our religion. And I think that for our congregation, this was a very challenging period of time. We were not able to gather on Palm Sunday in person, which is, which I grieve. Mm-hmm. We were pilloried in the national and international media, and our, you know, the good name of our congregation was dragged through the mud. And that's something that I do not accept. I'm not going to accept that as something right. which is simply par for the course or part of what it means to be a Christian in today's world. And so I think that our congregation learned that the stances that we have long taken for racial equity, anti-racism work, this is decades-long work that this congregation has been involved in for a long time, that this work is costly at times and joyful always and worth doing, particularly now.
Yeah. Talk a little bit more about what other churches need to learn from what you learned.
We have received so much support and love and solidarity from churches across the country. We've even received messages from Christians in the Netherlands, from as far away as the Netherlands. The church as a whole has been tremendously supportive, and I thank God for the church in this. And we as Christians, I think, need to learn that we have to stand up for one another's rights to be people of faith. And whether a church, whether a Christian in another part of the country or even here locally, whether they liked the way that we were practicing our Lenten fast or disliked it, mm-hmm. I would hope that they come away from this saying, I want my congregation to be able to proclaim the gospel as we see fit. And we must stand up for our ability to do that. Yeah. It is very easy to find ourselves bifurcated into one side and another side, one team and another team. And I would hope that all churches and people of all persuasions in this country would recognize that it is a foundational principle in our country that people of faith ought to be able to practice their faith freely and without the threat of intimidation or violence from any source.
And that makes me ask, did you have any idea this level of attack was even possible in the United States in 2022?
In something of an odd coincidence, I am the chair of a task force on the national level of the United Church of Christ, which is doing work, putting plans in place for congregations who find themselves targeted by extremism. And so I've been working on this for the better part of a year, even before this came knocking on our door. And so I know that there are places in this country, faith communities in this country, where pastors in my denomination have had rainbow painted doors of their church set on fire, who have made public proclamations of anti-racism work, putting up Black Lives banner signs, having those things defaced, having their homes surrounded by trucks with large floodlights on them in the middle of the night. These are things that are happening today in this country. And I knew that that was a part of what was going on. And perhaps out of naivete, I was surprised that this happened to us. that was still a surprise to me. And I came away from it understanding better some of the ways that this works in our country now. Mm-hmm. In particular, the way that this worked for us was Turning Point USA, which is a far-right organization, which your listeners can read more about on the Anti-Defamation League website or on the Southern Poverty Law Center website. This is an organization that has been under investigation for racial bias and illegal campaign activity. Turning Point USA began this whole process with a story that they published on their through their mechanisms. That was then picked up that very day, quoted verbatim and published simultaneously by Sinclair Broadcast Group affiliates. These are NBC, CBS, ABC affiliates across the country, broadcast that same day, quoted in its entirety, this Turning Point USA piece. This was the crucial moment in this, because what had been a far-right organization smear piece took on the veneer of legitimate journalism because of the action of Sinclair Broadcast Group to do this in this way. The next day, the Sinclair Broadcast Group pieces were quoted by the New York Post, by the Daily Mail, and the next day, Fox and Friends takes it up and says and begins their piece with, "You've got to hear this," as if it came as a surprise to them, rather than there being one part of a sophisticated media machine that is intent on fighting culture wars. And so that's how that happened for us. That's how that playbook worked and looked for us. And I know that even knowing what I do, I was still surprised that one church's little banner on their front lawn could become international news. That was still surprising.
The Reverend John Edgerton is lead pastor at United Church of Oak Park, Illinois. You can read more about the incredible attack from the right, the congregation's fast from whiteness sparked, in Fred Clarkson's Religion Dispatches article. And Nathan Imsall at Faithful America has launched a public response that he'd love your participation in. We'll link to both of those from stateofbelief.com. John, thank you so much for this measured and meaningful look at the terrifying aspect of the betraying of America's foundational values by the right wing and its minions. The conversation is sure to be a great value to many listeners of State of Belief. That's why we are so grateful that you joined us for this time today.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to be here. I appreciate it.